and loving as she was, someone like Helen. Emotional shaping in a mother's reactions. Infants being fitted for the first gender straitjacket. I believe the trauma of separation is one of the earliest and most acute developmental experiences boys endure, an experience that plays a large role in the hardening process through which society shames boys into suppressing their empathic and vulnerable sides. What few people realize is that this shame-based hardening process begins as early as the first months of a little boy's life as a narrowing of emotional expressiveness, and then continues during early childhood, following boys right through adolescence and manhood. It is, in other words, a lifelong process. Research on interactions between mothers and their babies illustrates how the process begins, revealing that, totally unaware of their actions' consequences, genuinely loving caretakers prematurely dampen their sons' sensitive, emotive sides. Boy infants, at birth and for months afterward, are much more expressive emotionally than girls. They startle, excite, cry, and fuss more than girls, though caregivers sometimes believe this infant emotionality is a sign of fragility or a lack of self-control rather than an enhanced communication of feelings. Haviland and Malatesta, in studies conducted at Rutgers University, found that in order to keep their sons' more volatile emotions in check, mothers tend unwittingly to mimic and overly reinforce smiling in boys while discouraging more unhappy emotions. Hence, without realizing it, in their attempt to be soothing, mothers are participating in the earliest phases of emotional straitjacketing in boys. They are teaching them to smile when they may not feel like it. Even infant boys are subject to the boy code. In general, the researchers found, mothers were far less likely to mirror their infants' unhappy feelings. But when mothers were interacting with infant boys, the mothers were particularly resistant to recognizing their sons' negative emotional states. When girl infants expressed painful states, mothers responded only 22% of the time. But when their sons showed negative feelings, they ignored them altogether. Haviland and Malatesta concluded that when mothers notice their baby boys showing greater emotionality, many of them fear their sons are psychologically off balance or unwell. To calm their sons, therefore, many of these mothers, often without realizing it, take steps that squelch their young sons' emotional expressiveness. While this difference between how mothers respond to the emotions of their infant sons and daughters is startling, I feel it is very important not to misinterpret these findings. The mothers studied, in my opinion, were not insensitive or indifferent to their sons' feelings. They were not neglecting their young sons' pain. Quite to the contrary, these mothers, based on cultural imperatives about boys and masculinity, were struggling to do what they felt was best, manifesting a knee-jerk reaction to their sons' expressions of distress. They were trying to smooth over their boys' emotions not out of callousness or a lack of caring, but out of empathy, because they loved their sons and wanted to see them happy and fulfilled. Far from being unsympathetic or neglectful, these mothers were concerned that if they let a boy express too much grief, pain, or vulnerability, somehow he would become something less than a real, fully functional boy, in accordance with our society's rigid code. The study conducted by Professors Haviland and Malatesta also investigated how mothers respond to their baby's expressions of surprise or special interest. Here, mothers more exactly mirrored their sons' feeling states by making surprised or excited faces whenever their sons made these kinds of faces. Hence, when a boy raised his eyebrows in surprise, so did his mother. When he acted startled, so did she. In other words, she kept the situation comfortably neutral and provided no additional stimulus of any kind. By contrast, mothers responded to their daughters' expressions of surprise or interest in ways that did not exactly mimic those of their daughters. In doing so, these mothers led their daughters to experience joyful stimulation, broadening and deepening the range of these girls' emotional responsiveness and experience. Again, researchers understood this difference not as a maternal deprivation of boys, but as a struggle on mothers' part to go to great lengths to ensure that their sons remain contented. In other words, just as mothers ignore their infant sons' sad faces in the hope their sons will simply snap out of it and feel happier, mothers try to closely mimic their young sons' expressions of surprise or special interest simply to avoid pushing their boys toward more distressing emotions, such as embarrassment, sadness, or fear. But it is my view that by encouraging their boys to achieve such narrow contentment, mothers, while they clearly do not intend to, are actually pushing their sons toward premature disconnection from the wide range of their true inner experience, and teaching them that experiencing certain kinds of emotions is either inappropriate or unnecessary. By suppressing their sons' vigorous expression of spontaneous, vulnerable feelings, mothers give boys the subliminal message that it is dangerous or shameful to manifest such feelings, and that these feelings do not have an important place within their mother-son relationship. Without any forethought, mothers, by coaching their sons in this way, unwittingly socialize their boys' natural emotional states into our highly limited repertoire of emotional expression for males, another early gender straitjacket. This is particularly unfortunate, since my research shows that what real boys actually need from infancy forward, and what mothers in their hearts are often longing to offer, is complete and unconditional empathy and understanding for a full range of feelings. Ideally, when a mother sees her infant son looking unhappy, she would simply gaze gently into his eyes, hold him close, and ask him something like, "What's going on? Are you okay? You're feeling tired, aren't you?" These expressions of love and empathy are truly what most boys, like most girls, need when they are feeling discomforted or afraid. Regrettably, research shows that the suppression of emotions in boys continues through childhood. For example, not only do mothers allow girls to express a greater range of emotional states as infants, but as girls get older, mothers also simply communicate more with them than with boys. Leslie Brody at Boston University summarized her own and others' research as demonstrating that mothers not only speak more to daughters about feelings, but actually display a wider range of feelings to them as well. Mothers, in communicating with their daughters, as compared with their sons, may actually use more vivid facial expressions, allowing both girl and mother to develop better skills at recognizing each other's emotions. But with sons, Brody explained, perhaps to adjust to these boys' more intense emotions, such as anger or irritability, mothers tended to hold back, to respond less expressively. This is a set of complex findings, precisely because, as Brody reminds us, these natural styles of interaction tend to conform to the cultural stereotype that girls should be more emotionally expressive and that boys should be more emotionally constrained. As their sons grow older, Caretakers use a greater variety of emotion-laden language when they speak to their preschool daughters than to their sons. These studies show that mothers talk more about sadness or distress with daughters and about anger with sons, tending to minimize the extent to which their sons might attempt to dwell on their sadness. For example, if a girl begins to cry when she gets a bad grade at school, her parents might tend to say things such as, "Oh, you must feel awful," or, "Are you all right?" Whereas if a boy begins to cry when he suffers the same fate, they might say, "How unfair, that's ridiculous," or, "You march right in there and tell them this just isn't right." Though it is unintentional, such gender straitjacketing takes its toll. By the time they reach school age, little girls expect mothers to respond positively to their expression of sadness, while little boys expect both mothers and fathers to respond far less warmly to their expression of the same emotion. Also, by the time girls and boys have reached this age, boys simply express less sadness than girls, and thus self-regulate how much they show negative or vulnerable emotions. Indeed, research shows that the older a boy is, the less emotionally responsive he will be, and the harder it will be for his mother to tell how he is feeling. Lest anyone begin to believe that mothers are alone in this emotional shaping process, it is important to point out that when fathers become actively involved in their children's care, they too, perhaps especially so, push boys to limit their expression of emotional vulnerability. Fathers use many more emotion words with daughters than with sons, with only one exception. With their sons, they use one word they rarely say to their daughters: disgust. The language of fathers in general, with boys or with girls, has more demands and teasing in it than in the mother's language, and the demands and teasing are even more persistent and intense when the father is addressing his sons. Such verbal jousting by fathers with their sons, for example, the use of a taunt such as, "You ding-a-ling," is usually playful, uttered in jest. But when we think about how such teasing affects boys in combination with all the other social pressures they face at such a young age, it is hard not to conclude that such jousting serves only to further toughen up boys, adding heavy plating to their already weighty emotional armor and pushing their more tender feelings underground. Anger, the okay male emotion. While studies show that boys at a very early age are pushed to suppress their vulnerable and sad feelings, they also demonstrate that boys are pressured to express the one strong feeling allowed them, anger. Several research centers have documented that parents speak more about sadness with daughters, but when it comes to sons, parents speak mostly about anger. In Professor Esther Grief's work with colleagues at Boston University, mothers were asked to create a story with their children. When performing this task, mothers never used the word angry with girls, but frequently used it with boys. In Professor Robin Fivish's laboratory at Emory University, parents not only focused on anger more frequently with their sons, but also, when guiding their sons and daughters through conflict situations, they favored the reestablishing of harmony when their daughters were involved, but accepted retaliation as a reasonable solution for their male progeny. Unfortunately, it is through anger, the final common pathway for a boy's strong feelings, what Professor Don Long at Washington University has called an emotional funnel, that most boys express their vulnerability and powerlessness. In the face of a premature separation, boys turn most to anger in order to mute and rein in the full range of emotional responsiveness they would otherwise exhibit. The more tender feelings seem too shameful to show, and thus boys turn to anger. When I consider these studies, when I think about how difficult it is for many of the adolescent boys and men I know to cope with intense emotional situations, it becomes clear why anger has always been the easiest feeling for men to express. Understandably, it is very challenging for most men to express or experience emotions other than anger, since, as boys, they were encouraged to use their rage to express the full range of their emotional experience. Sam and Oscar. How shame-phobic boys become hardened men. Starting during infancy with the trauma of separation, and persisting during early childhood and adolescence, the shame-hardening process continues throughout the lives of our boys and men. It is a process that causes boys and men to develop a thick skin, a strong resistance to showing any emotions that might lead them to feel ashamed. This hardening comes not from a boy's desire to be either courageous or cold-hearted, but rather from an intense wish to protect himself from losing face or feeling otherwise dishonored. Sometimes, especially with adult men, it is easy to misinterpret this hardening as a kind of typical male boasting or bluster. Sam Gash, described as a fierce blocker for the New England Patriots football team, bemoaned the knee injury that had placed him on the bench. Watching the action without being part of it, he explained, "was the worst thing I've ever had to endure." When asked how he might cope with a more serious injury that could end his career, let alone leave his body paralyzed, he responded as if from behind a typical male mask, "Hey, if that's God's will, that's the way it will be. I approach the game as if I have a big shield around me, God's armor. I'm not really afraid of anything." If we were to take Sam Gash's testimony at face value, it would be hard not to think he was just a thoroughly tough, powerful, self-confident man. But when we look closely at the behavior of young boys, and when we listen closely to their stories, we realize that what in men or older boys is often interpreted as a macho sense of rigor and cockiness, in reality often has much more to do with hardening. This hardening takes place, and the mask goes up, not because boys or men feel particularly strong or self-assured, but rather because they don't. They feel anxious to protect themselves from wounds to their already fragile male psyches. Once they have been shamed enough for failing to be fully masculine, once they've been told enough times that they should suppress their vulnerable feelings, once they've actually been physically injured for failing to meet the mark, boys allow the wounds to scar over, cover any remaining soft tissue, and act as if everything is going all right. Take, for instance, Oscar De La Hoya, who today is an Olympic gold medal winner and known as a golden boy of boxing. As a young boy, Oscar was pushed into the sport by his father as a result of an unhappy childhood episode. Oscar recalls that during his third birthday party, he became frightened by the violence of the traditional piñata game. This is the game in which he and each of his friends were blindfolded and then, using a long wooden cane, were asked to take turns whacking the multicolored toy-stuffed doll that was suspended above them by a cord. "I got scared," Oscar remembered. "I started to cry hysterically and ran away in panic." Oscar's parents not only threatened but punished him, but nothing could get him back to that fearsome scene. Later, his father saw Oscar fleeing from other boys when they threatened to punch him. His father felt that Oscar's lack of manliness was a disgrace, a shame upon the family. The best medicine for his son, he felt, was to teach him to box. After all, that's what Oscar's grandfather had done one generation earlier with Oscar's father, when he, too, had seemed unmanly. Oscar vividly remembers his first attempt at boxing when he was just 5 years of age. The match began, he recalls, and the next thing, wham! The first punch thrown lands smack on my nose. Oscar ran home in tears, but from that time on, he recalls, I learned to manage my fears. Like so many boys, Oscar learned how to harden himself, in this case with the encouragement of his father. By training himself in a sport where he would need to withstand both emotional and physical pain, and by resolving to no longer allow himself to experience or show his fears, Oscar, at the ripe age of 5, was already mastering the hardening expected of boys. Hardening's risk, becoming anesthetized to pain. When boys become hardened, they become willing to endure emotional and physical pain, even to risk their lives, if it means winning the approval of their peers. Boys can become so thoroughly hardened that they literally anesthetize themselves against the pain they must cope with. And because they are left unsupervised at an earlier age than girls, and are usually discouraged by adults from engaging in help-seeking behaviors at their time of greatest vulnerability or need, boys learn to remain silent despite their suffering. Studies show, for instance, that though by the time boys reach junior high school, 1 in 10 of them has been kicked in the groin, and though 25% of these boys actually suffer injuries to their groin area, the majority never tell an adult. 1 year after the trauma, 25% show signs of depression, and 12% manifest post-traumatic syndromes. And in a study the Navy recently commissioned to understand the history of childhood sexual abuse in its female recruits, researchers made the entirely unexpected finding that as many as 39% of its male recruits had experienced some form of physical violence, beyond spanking, at the hands of the parents before they reached the age of 18. While this statistic is disturbing in and of itself, what is particularly striking is that, unless the Navy had decided to commission this study, this abuse by parents of their sons would never have been revealed. Once boys have become hardened, they often cover their pain so masterfully that we as a society become utterly incapable of seeing it. It's really hard being a guy, 15-year-old Calvin Branford recently explained to me. Because you're not supposed to talk about how you feel. There's nobody you can depend on. With girls, everybody expects they'll go off and talk to somebody. When you're a guy, you're really not allowed to do that. I guess it's pretty hard being a guy because there are so many things a normal person would probably do, but you're just not expected to. Helping boys reconnect. A primer for parents. As powerful as the cultural imperatives of the boy code may be in pushing boys of all ages to separate from their parents, toughen themselves up, and restrict their emotional lives, there is a lot we can do as adults to help boys overcome these conventional pressures. Here are some basic guidelines I would suggest. At least once a day, give your boy your undivided attention. This means you're not speaking with someone else, You're not simultaneously trying to cook, clean, read, or do some other task. You're listening closely. He's got your attention. While sometimes he may not want to talk, while he may just want to play a game, get some help on his homework, or complain about having to do chores, showing him this attention, even if he doesn't always soak it up, gives him the message that you're there, that you care, and that he has a daily time and place when he can share things with you. It's not important that he always unload heavy emotions on you, and he may signal that he prefers to talk about things at some later point. He just needs to feel your regular loving presence and know that you're eager to know what's happening in his world. Encourage the expression of a full range of emotions. From the moment a boy is born and throughout his life, it's important he gets the message that all of his emotions are valid. With an infant, this means we need to mirror back all of the feelings the baby expresses. Rather than forcing him to constantly smile or laugh, we also need to show him we're receptive to his sadness, fear, or other painful emotions. So when a young infant begins to frown, yawn, kick, or cry, rather than trying to cheer him up or smooth things over by making happy faces at him or ignoring his displays of discomfort, show him your empathy. Let him know you understand how he's feeling. And show him with your words, facial expressions, and gestures that you respect and understand his genuine feelings. With toddlers and school-age boys, we need to ask questions. What happened? Are you feeling sad about something? Tell me what's making you unhappy. And again express our empathy. Gee, that sounds unfair. I'm sorry it hurts so much. We also need to use a broad range of emotion words. Happy, sad, tired, disappointed, scared, nervous. Rather than limiting our discussion of emotions to words such as anger that force boys to channel the gamut of their feelings into one word and one emotion. In our daily attention-giving time with our sons, we need to pay close attention to what he's saying and how he's acting. If he complains, expresses fears or anxieties, cries, or otherwise shows emotions that reveal he's hurting, ask him what he's going through and let him talk about all that he is experiencing. With an older boy, be sure to ask him questions about his relationships with girls, with other boys, with his siblings, teachers, and other friends and acquaintances. Ask him to share with you not only what's going well in those relationships, but also what's going less well. Ask him what he enjoys about them and what he finds difficult. By probing about both the positive and negative sides of these relationships, older boys will begin to discuss a broad array of thoughts and feelings. When a boy expresses vulnerable feelings, avoid teasing or taunting him. While it's natural to want to be playful with our sons, and though showing him a sense of levity and good cheer sometimes helps him to overcome unpleasant feelings or situations, by and large, it's important that we not cut off his painful emotions by teasing or taunting him. So, for example, when he comes home and complains that his teacher told him he needs a haircut, rather than teasing that he sure looks like a real fuzzball, ask him how his teacher's comments made him feel. Hear him out, and tell him that you too don't appreciate what the teacher said. Or if your teenage son announces despondently that his sweetheart just dumped him, rather than joking that it must have been his bad breath that got to her, or that his heart must just be totally broken, instead, ask him if he'd like to talk about it, and if so, listen to what he'd like to share with you and try to mirror back, in an empathic way, the feelings you sense he's trying to convey. Teasing and taunting rarely heal the boy. Empathy, however, goes miles to help him learn how to express and cope with a broad range of feelings. Avoid using shaming language in talking with a boy. Research, as well as everyday observation, reveals that parents often, although unintentionally, use shaming language with their male children that they do not use with girls. It's important to find ways to talk with boys that do not shame them, and that they can respond to. If a boy does something that surprises or concerns you, a natural reaction is to ask, "How could you do that?" But that implies that the act, whatever it was wrong, and casts the boy in the role of the evil perpetrator. Rather, you might ask, "What's going on?" or "What happened?" which suggests that you have not formed a judgment about the situation under discussion. If a boy comes home with a less-than-stellar report card, a parent, understandably concerned, may challenge him and deliver an ultimatum, "You're going to have to work harder than this. These grades won't get you into a good college." Undoubtedly, the boy knows he is not performing as well as others, or as well as he would like. The better parental response might be, "You're still struggling with math, aren't you? What could we do to help?" Or suppose a boy declines an invitation to visit a friend or go to a party. Rather than say, "It would do you good to get out of the house. Besides, that boy is really nice," you could try to find out why the boy no longer wants to be with his friend. Has something happened between you two guys? Or what it is about the party that doesn't appeal to him? Will somebody be there you don't get along with? Such language carries tremendous power to make a boy feel shame and to reinforce his own conception that he is somehow toxic. Look behind anger, aggression, and rambunctiousness. In so many cases, a boy who seems angry, displays a lot of aggression, or is constantly rambunctious, is indirectly asking for our help. If you notice a boy who's acting in such ways, try to create a setting where he'll feel comfortable talking with you, and then ask him how things are with him. With a young boy, you might not be able to ask him a lot of direct questions, and he may not yet be able to talk about feelings in a clear way. But try your best to get a sense of what he's feeling. For instance, if you notice that your son has seemed angry a lot lately, you might say, "Gosh, you've seemed upset a lot. Is everything okay? Have things been rough for you lately?" Or, if you're a school teacher and you notice a boy who's constantly roughing up and provoking other kids, rather than chastising the boy, ask him how things are at home. Ask him if he's upset about something. Try to get a sense of whether there might be deeper, more vulnerable feelings that are motivating his anger or rowdy behavior. You might even tell him that sometimes when we act irritably or show aggression, we might be feeling sadness or other upset feelings. Express your love and empathy openly and generously. Despite all the messages you might receive about letting go of your son, of not staying too attached to him, of not babying him, you simply can never show him too much love or empathy. Cutting off your affection and support to let him stand on his own, as we've discussed in this chapter, can actually traumatize him. Tell your boy that you love him as often as you like. Give him hugs. Tell him you're proud of him and that you care about him. Stay involved in his emotional life. seek opportunities to connect with him for moments of playful closeness and emotional sharing. If he asks you to let him alone, give him the space he needs, but let him know that you love him very much and that when he's ready to spend time together, you'll be up for it. You cannot spoil your son with too much love or attention. You will not make him girl-like or feminine by maintaining a close relationship. There's simply no such thing as too much love. Let boys know that they don't need to be sturdy oaks. So many boys, even at a very young age, feel that they need to act like a sturdy oak. When there are problems at home, when he suffers his own failures or disappointments, or when there's a need for somebody who's physically or emotionally strong for others to lean on, and he feels he has to be that support, the boy is often pushed to act like a man, to be the one who is confident and unflinching. No boy should be called upon to be the tough one. No boy should be hardened in this way. So, through thick and thin, let your boy know that he doesn't have to act like a sturdy oak. Talk to him honestly about your own fears and vulnerabilities, and encourage him to do the same. The more genuine he feels he can be with you, the more he'll be free to express his vulnerability, and the stronger he will become. Create a model of masculinity for him that is broad and inclusive. Despite all the narrow messages about being a guy that they may get at school, on television, or elsewhere, you can help boys to create their own model of masculinity. Try to help them develop a model that is broad and inclusive. Try to do for them what we have done for girls by valuing them as people before evaluating them as a distinct and therefore restricted gender. This means encouraging boys in all their interests, relationships, and activities. It means letting them know that big guys do cry. It also means exposing boys to people who bend society's strict gender rules, to men who are nurses, women who are plumbers, girls who are jocks, boys who cook, and so on. Boys especially benefit from getting to know adult male role models who exude masculinity in a genuine and expansive way. When you give your son a sense that there's no one single way of being manly, you're helping him develop confidence about who he really is. You're letting him know that no matter what he enjoys doing, whom he likes spending time with, and what sorts of feelings he experiences, he's a real boy on his way to being a real man. Chapter 3. Real Boys: The Truths Behind the Myths. Sometimes, just because you're a guy, people treat you like you're a little hoodlum. I think if they opened up their eyes, they'd see that most of us are actually pretty good people. Dirk, age 17. Though the stereotypes about what boys are and how boys should behave continue to be perpetuated, in our hearts, many of us know that these outdated ideas are simply untrue. And we now have research confirming what most of us have always known. There are three major myths about boys that persist in all kinds of situations and among all sorts of people, even among the most thoughtful and progressive families, schools, and communities. They are so deeply embedded in the culture that without realizing it, they often short-circuit our ability to see and love the real boy before us, the true boy behind these old-fashioned ideas. Myth number one. Boys will be boys. Nature and testosterone win out over nurture. One myth, which recent studies, including my own, show to be untrue, is that nature controls much about a boy's behavior. More specifically, that where there are boys, there is testosterone, and where there is testosterone, there is aggression, and where there is aggression, there is violence, or at least its potential. The phrase, boys will be boys, is saying, in effect, that boys are prisoners of biology, that their behavior is predetermined, an inherent part of their nature. Typical boy behavior is assumed to involve insensitivity and risk-taking. The phrase is used when a little boy breaks a window with a baseball and runs away laughing, or when a teenager skateboards into traffic, narrowly avoids a collision, and zooms away, or when an older adolescent stays up until 4 in the morning playing Doom and drags himself to school the next day. Boys will be boys is not said, however, when a little boy brings a present to his teacher or gives his crying mother a hug, or when a teenage boy obviously feels racked with guilt for breaking up with his girlfriend, unless he covers it up with a convincing show of apathy, or when an older boy spends time with a dying parent in the hospital, unless he takes the opportunity to watch football on the hospital room television. The great danger in subscribing to the myth is that it tends to make people assume that they have less power to affect a boy's personality, behavior, or emotional development than in fact they do. Truth number one. A boy's behavior is shaped more by loved ones than by nature. Underlying the boys will be boys myth is a misconception about the role of testosterone. Testosterone does contribute to a boy's natural patterns of behavior, but testosterone is not necessarily the major factor in determining a boy's behavior. It's true that many boys enjoy being active. For most little boys, running hard across the playground, kicking a soccer ball, or zooming down the slide is action enough. I might add that plenty of little girls take delight in these very same activities. We don't apply the boys will be boys myth to that kind of typical boy behavior until it takes on a careless edge, when the running turns into a race, when the ball gets kicked at someone, or when the boy leans over the edge of the slide, daring himself to fall off. The unfortunate effect of the myth is that it allows us to shrug off a boy's behavior when it crosses the line from active to aggressive. We are more inclined to throw up our hands and say, "We can't do anything about it. That's the way boys are." But I strongly believe that a boy's behavior can be shaped, that any natural need for action can be encouraged and satisfied, and any impulses toward violence and aggression can be discouraged and channeled in creative, positive directions. The case of Kyle illustrates my point. Kyle was 6 when his sister Charlotte was born. "We expected Kyle to show the usual sibling jealousy," says his mother, Roberta. "But he was much worse with her than we'd expected. Kyle showed no delight in having a new member of the family, and demonstrated no affection for her. He would poke her with his toys and make faces at her as if he was completely disgusted with her existence. One day, we put Charlotte down for a nap. She slept longer than usual, and my husband, Don, went in to check on her. He found Kyle in the room with her, with his hands close to her neck. It looked for all the world like Kyle might strangle his baby sister. Don rushed to grab him and realized that Kyle was just pretending. The baby was fine. She hadn't even woken up. But both Don and I completely lost our tempers. I rarely yell at my kids, but this time I just went over the edge. I felt as if there was something horribly wrong with my son, that he had a violent nature or something, and this incident had revealed his true self. I didn't try to understand what prompted his action I viewed my baby daughter, a girl, as a helpless victim, and my boy as the aggressor. Roberta told her friends about what had happened and asked them for advice. I was very worried about Charlotte's well-being. Don was an only child in his family, and I was the youngest child in mine, so neither one of us could really relate to what Kyle was going through. Finally, my friend Gloria helped me understand how Kyle might be feeling. Gloria, the oldest of three children, explained how her life had changed when her two siblings came along. She had not been consulted in the decision to bring other children into the home. Children rarely are. When her siblings first arrived, Gloria lost her status as the special, the only child. She received far less attention than she'd had before. She had to share her parents and their limited resources of energy with two other children. Gloria made me understand how much better things were for Kyle before Charlotte appeared, and I had to admit it was true. Kyle got our undivided attention before. Now it was hard to find the time or the energy to play with him. Roberta and Don determined to work with Kyle to change his attitude toward Charlotte, to curb his aggression, and to help him understand that his parents still loved him as much as ever. Together, the three of them read stories about big brother-little sister relationships, which sparked lots of conversation about the topic. Once we convinced Kyle that we weren't going to blame him or punish him for his natural feelings, Roberta recalled, he opened up. We had some really good talks with him, and we told him he would always be our special boy. Kyle's become a very caring brother, Roberta now says. One day, he spent an hour drawing an elaborate picture of our family, including Charlotte, and he told me he wanted to give it to his baby sister as a present. Today, he's the kind of brother I'd hoped he would be. He knows that we're not going to abandon him for Charlotte, and he feels comfortable enough to share us with her. I can even laugh now at the memory of him pretending to strangle Charlotte, because I know he never would and never could do such a thing. He's not a violent person. He was just in a very difficult situation and couldn't express his feelings about it, and we certainly weren't helping him any. My clinical experience and research, as well as work done by others, have shown that most boys, when lovingly nurtured themselves, will in turn nurture and show empathy for others. We have learned that the way parents care for their sons has an even more powerful effect on a boy's behavior than we had realized, an effect at least as strong as biology in determining a boy's nature. How you treat a boy has a powerful impact on who he becomes. He is as much a product of nurturing as he is of nature. The myth about testosterone. The idea that high levels of testosterone equate with high levels of violence stems from a mistaken assumption that testosterone is the only force that inclines boys toward both active, rough-and-tumble play, and violent behavior. This is not the case. Boys do play differently than girls, but their style of play is not solely a function of testosterone, and it certainly does not prove a proclivity for violence. Boys, in general, like play that is competitive, physically rough, and forceful. They like games that involve interaction in large groups and take place in large spaces, such as playing fields, gymnasiums, stadiums, as well as those that follow rules and have a hierarchy of authority. Girls, on the other hand, generally enjoy play that is more interpersonal, often one-on-one, and less physically aggressive. Although scientists have long recognized the differences between the play styles of girls and boys, and continue to debate the evolutionary and hormonal influences, they have not been able to establish a clear link between boys' rough play and aggression or violence. While testosterone does in fact contribute to boys' proclivity for action, scientists over the years have tried without success to establish an unequivocal link between testosterone and violent behavior. The fact is that testosterone is just one of many biological factors, including serotonin, that have an influence on aggression. In addition, testosterone can have a variety of different effects on boys' behavior. A high testosterone level in one boy may enable him to play a chess match with great intensity and alertness. In another, it may give him the energy and concentration to make complicated arrangements for a political rally. In a third case, it may contribute to his involvement in a brutal fistfight. But the amount of testosterone in a boy's system fluctuates depending on when it is measured and the activities he has been involved in, rather like the pulse rate. In older men, the effects of testosterone vary from man to man. Research has also shown that when older men are given supplemental testosterone, they become calmer and less aggressive than before. By contrast, when athletes take anabolic steroids, the cousins of testosterone, they become ornery and excitable. No simple scientific link has been made between testosterone levels and the tendency for aggression and violence. The level of testosterone in any boy and the way that testosterone affects him has less impact on his behavior than how the boy is loved, nurtured, and shaped by his parents, and by the context of the society within which he lives. The hormone may well predict a certain type of energy in boys, but the way in which that energy is funneled and expressed lies in our hands. The potency of connection, the power of parenting to affect our boys' brains. Parents and others who love and look after boys are empowered in their efforts by their boys' own deep yearning for connection. This is what I call the potency of connection. The power of love can dispel the myth that, in boys, nature and nurture are at odds, or indeed have distinct separate influences on a boy in his life. The way we interact with boys and the connections we make with them can have a permanent effect on a boy's biology, his brain, and his social behavior. Scientists have found that early emotional interaction can actually alter a boy's brain-based biological processes. When a boy or girl is born, the baby's brain, unlike the brain of any other primate, is not fully developed. In the first year of life, a child's brain doubles in size, and then doubles again. By the time a child reaches the age of 2, his or her brain has as many synapses, connections between brain cells, as an adult's. During this period of development, the human brain is very pliable and plastic, and, more than in any other species, is very open to learning from emotional and cognitive experiences. The human brain can, in fact, be permanently altered by its environment in these early years of its life. Scientists have demonstrated that at birth, the human brain is wired to accommodate developmental interactions that further shape the nervous system after birth, with profound consequences for lifelong functioning. How we respond to our baby boys and young sons, the manner in which we cuddle, kiss, and reassure, teach, comfort, and love, not only determines a young boy's capacity for a healthy emotional start in life, but deeply affects a boy's characteristic style of behavior and the development of his brain. Our behavior fundamentally and at times irrevocably alters a boy's neural connections, brain chemistry, and biological functioning. the capacity to use language, to tolerate distress, to show and name feelings, and to be timid or eager to explore, are all dramatically affected by the emotional environment created for a boy during early childhood. While nature creates boys whose behavior is influenced by biological proclivities, more than we used to believe, nature also creates boys who are more receptive to interaction with their caretakers than we had ever imagined. Bruce Perry, a developmental neurobiologist at Baylor College of Medicine, summarizes it this way. A child's capacity to think, to laugh, to love, to hate, to speak, all of it is a product of interaction with the environment. Sensory experiences such as touching literally stimulate activity in the brain and the growth of neural structures. The people in a boy's life, moms and dads, teachers and siblings, coaches and ministers, daycare providers and doctors, may have an effect equal to that of testosterone in shaping a young boy, not only by influencing his formative experience, but by affecting his brain structures and neurotransmitters. The potency of connection is not just about the power adults have to create safe, nurturing, holding environments. It is also about how these caring environments, in turn, affect the biological development of infant and toddler brains. Modern science has demonstrated how easily nurture becomes nature. There is no rigid dichotomy between the two. So let's rid ourselves of the myth that boys can never escape their biological fates. The truth is that we can do a great deal to shape how a boy behaves. We can search for ways to celebrate our boy's energy and channel it into positive and productive activities. If they feel the urge to hit, let's give them a punching bag and help them learn to box. If they want to scream and yell, let's play a game that gives them a chance to cheer. If they want to argue, let's engage them in a conversation that allows them to develop their debating skills. If they refuse to do what's on the family agenda, let's challenge them to come up with an alternative plan. Myth number two, boys should be boys. The myth that boys should be boys, that they must fulfill the stereotype of the dominant and macho male, inhibits some parents and their sons from living in the way that comes most naturally to them. The boy code says that boys should be tough, should demand respect from others, and should never act like a girl. As soon as a boy behaves in a way that is not considered manly, that falls outside the boy code, he is likely to meet resistance from society. He may merely be stared at or whispered about, he may be humiliated, he may get a punch in the gut, or he may just feel terribly ashamed. When 8-year-old Ethan tells his physical education teacher that he would rather jump rope than play basketball with the boys, some of his second-grade classmates cannot contain their laughter. The teacher smiles indulgently, but pushes Ethan firmly in the direction of the basketball courts. 13-year-old Stephen arrives at school with flesh-toned acne lotion covering an embarrassingly large pimple on his nose. His peers tease him about how pretty he looks. They humiliate him by asking whether he forgot to put on his lipstick, or what color dress he plans to wear to the dance that night. When 17-year-old Brad reads a poem in English class with dramatic intensity, there are a few sniggers from the back row. Later, someone mocks his recitation, adding an exaggerated lisp and whispering loud enough for all to hear, "Faggot." When boys act in less than conventionally masculine ways, their peers, both boys and girls, can be quick to tighten the laces on their gender straitjackets. Some parents, teachers, coaches, and other mentors also act in ways that reinforce society's myths about masculinity by letting boys know when they are violating the boy code. Jennifer, a teacher at a Boston-area preschool, is 36 years old and holds degrees in childhood development from Wellesley and Harvard. She asked for my advice about one of her students, 4-year-old Benjamin. "He still wants to play the mother and put on jewelry in the dress-up corner," she told me. "When I suggest something else for him to do, he cries in front of all the other kids. He seems perfectly healthy otherwise," she explained, "but I'm getting worried about whether he's really ready for kindergarten." Didn't I see Lisa wearing a cowboy hat and slapping her thigh like a horse the other day? I asked. "Sure," Jennifer said, "but all the girls do that." Even this well-educated, highly competent and sensitive teacher was influenced by the boys-should-be-boys myth. Playing mother and putting on jewelry did not constitute healthy boy behavior. I witnessed similar attitudes at another private school that prided itself on being progressive. Recently, they had instituted a co-ed program called Boxing Can Be Safe, designed to help kindergarten kids express their anger. I attended one of these kindergarten boxing matches and watched as 5-year-old Michael, who stood no taller than 3 feet, made an awkward attempt at a punch. "Not like that, Michael," the coach admonished him. "You're swinging like a girl." It's hard to imagine how damaging these reproaches must be for boys. As a therapist, working with young people as well as adults, I have been through countless sessions with adult men who shared painful memories about being shamed as children for not being manly enough, for not being like the other boys. Especially for very young boys, the humiliation leaves them feeling that there is no place to turn. Without safe places where they can voice their pain or discuss their shame and deep embarrassment, many boys begin to toughen themselves up into little men. They become cut off from their own feelings, and their voices no longer fully connect with their emotional selves. As difficult as the shame-hardening process is for boys, it is almost equally difficult for parents to watch. In many ways, the myth that boys should be boys shields us as adults from dealing with our own pain and frustration as we observe our boys going through this extremely upsetting process. Perhaps by accepting the myth that boys must learn on their own how to act, must be like other masculine boys and tough it out, we somehow make ourselves feel more comfortable that this process is a necessary rite of passage, a natural part of growing up as a boy. Adult men in particular may rely on this myth to protect themselves from remembering how hurtful this hardening process was in their own childhood. Truth number 2. There are many ways to be a boy. The diversity of masculinity. The truth is that the boy code is based on a stereotype unique to our culture and time. There is no one correct pathway to healthy masculinity. Boys have been defined very differently in other countries, other cultures, and other eras. For example, in one country, crying may be expected of boys and men, whereas in another it may be expressly forbidden. Many parents today feel terribly ill at ease and struggle with the myths of boyhood, knowing in their hearts that they do not truly reflect the true nature of their own boys. Others, who have taken the time to fully examine the validity of the myths, refuse to accept the boy code and actively seek to break free of it. Often these parents are able, in turn, to help their sons break free of the code. When they feel comfortable that they will not be humiliated by girls or other boys for doing so, many boys derive tremendous joy from participating in a full range of playful, expressive, and creative activities, which was how a young man called Kip was able to create a wonderful life for himself. In high school, Kip had spent every waking hour, when he wasn't doing schoolwork or helping out at his father's small business, practicing, living, and breathing basketball. He dreamed of being the next Larry Bird, Michael Jordan, or Shaquille O'Neal. He was good enough to make the All-State team and received a basketball scholarship to Duke University. During his first game of the season, Kip's career aspirations came to an abrupt end. An elbow to the ribs caused a hard fall to the parquet and a serious knee injury. That night, the Duke doctors told him the bad news. His knee could not be repaired. He would have to forget about a career in the NBA. Kip spent months moping and feeling sorry for himself. He relived the moment when he took the hit, wondering if he could have turned away from that fateful elbow or fallen differently to avoid the injury. Finally, he faced up to the fact that he would not be the next Larry Bird. He decided that he would have to reinvent himself. But because he was a mediocre student, Kip figured that he would not be accepted into business school and that a business career was not an option for him. One day, he had an inspiration. He had another skill besides basketball, although he had never taken it very seriously. He was an inventive cook. He had grown up in a close and loving Italian family and had often helped his mother in the kitchen. She had always said that he had culinary talent, and she loved to tell her friends about his skill with bruschetta and fresh pasta and ossobuco. Kip wondered if he could make a career as a chef. He also wondered if it would be an acceptable career for an ex-basketball player, a jock. Kip mentioned the idea to his father and hinted at his reservations. "Hey, Kip, there's nothing wrong with wearing an apron," his father responded. "It's a uniform, just like wearing basketball shorts, maybe even better. Anybody who thinks you can't be a man and be a chef has never tasted a really great fettuccine Alfredo." The next month, Kip enrolled at the Cordon Bleu cooking school in Paris. 5 years later, Kip was one of the most celebrated chefs in Denver and had employment offers from 3 restaurants in New York City. A well-known food and wine magazine hailed him as one of the stars of American cuisine. If you had told Kip when he was 10 that he would become a chef, he probably would have scoffed at the idea. But he came to understand that his ability to be effective with the big round ball was not so different from his ability to be creative in the art of cooking. "I'm not doing what I expected to do when I was a kid," Kip concluded. "But I think I had a very limited view of what a man should do with his life. Now I don't think there's anything less masculine about being a chef than being a forward." There is no single path to a healthy and mature masculinity. A good school or home environment will send the message that activities like sports, acting in a school play, and volunteering at the local nursing home all provide equally good ways to succeed in the journey from boyhood into manhood. When I am advising parents about boys, I encourage them to follow their own instincts about their son's need for love and nurturing. Mothers and fathers need to feel secure that there is no such thing as giving their son too much love. Within appropriate limits, you will never spoil a boy by showing him affection or by providing him with the freedom to follow his own path. The Reverend Tony Jarvis, headmaster of one of Boston's most prestigious independent schools for boys, ends many a private interview with a troubled high school senior, perhaps a 6-foot, 250-pound fullback, with, "You know I love you."